When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for my podcast, Great New American Essays. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's spotlight is on the literary magazine, The American Scholar. I'm joined by the magazine's senior editor, Stephanie Bastek, joining me today from New York City. Stephanie has been the American Scholar's senior editor for the past 10 years. She hosts and produces the magazine's Smarty Pants podcast, which has just returned with a new miniseries called Exploding the Canon about the student protests at her alma mater, Reed College, over the mandatory freshman humanities course 8 years ago. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you, Dan.
So tell me a bit about the American Scholar. Where's it standing? What distinguishes it? What's unique? What's its niche?
Well, what I love about the American Scholar is that we are not trying to respond immediately to events as they happen. In a way that I think a weekly or a monthly or even a bi-monthly might feel compelled to do. So we can take a long view on current events or politics. We do like to have our finger on the pulse of what's happening, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, an essay that we publish is going to respond with the hottest new take. We're always looking for something that is a bit more far-ranging in its view, a little bit maybe interdisciplinary, that's looking at, you know, the historical angle or the literary angle or an unexpected connection that the writer has made or an unexpected depth to a particular topic. So we cover a huge range of subjects. I think the essays we're going to talk about today demonstrate that. Yes. But, you know, there's always something that makes something a scholar piece to me, and that tends to be that unusual angle or that sort of longer view on the subject.
Sure. And it allows for a bit more reflection than pushing out the piece the day after the news event happened. Sure.
Totally.
I get it. So yes, indeed, you sent me over some issues. And I was really struck by a number of these. And I think we both loved Shooting a Dog by Hugh Martin. This is about the author serving in Iraq. There's a parallel to George Orwell. If you want to explicate the essay just a bit, and then I'll push the conversation from there.
Yeah. So my colleague Bruce Falconer edited this piece, and I love it. It's super surprising. I think you start out thinking that this is just another story about an Iraq War veteran whose troop encountered a dog and had to shoot it. But over the course of the essay, Hugh unspools this really complex narrative that engages with the history of war writing about this conflict in particular. And, you know, we have just one sort of small event, essentially. We're in Iraq where a small dog has been injured and the troop has to decide what to do with it. And so the Americans decide they're going to put it out of its misery and send it on its way over the Rainbow Bridge. And in the process, we go from that beginning of that to sort of the dog's final fate. The time that this happens in is very brief, but the essay uses that as a framing device to go in all kinds of directions about, you know, how dogs in particular have been used in the Iraq War and, you know, various writings about it since.
Yeah, well, in fact, he admits that he's afraid an American audience, quite honestly, will sympathize more with the dog than it might have with the locals being harmed or killed for that matter, which is shocking, and yet I can see that being a case. I was also intrigued by the masculine angle, because he talked about male pride and how that factors into the dog being shot. So we got male pride, and we've got machismo at the national level, also the American, you know, pride. Can you talk to those two things, maybe?
Yeah, I think what the essay does really well is it balances the personal and the political on a government level in a really interesting way. And it never stops feeling like Hugh's own story and Hugh's own understanding of this one event with the dog. But at the same time, he's wrestling with, like, well, why did I go? Why did I want to be deployed? What compelled me? And sort of wrestles with the concept that we would now call perhaps fragile masculinity, and goes into, well, maybe does that really capture what the feeling was? And how does that relate to the kinds of things that George Orwell was talking about in Shooting an Elephant, for example, about his experiences in Burma? It's a really shocking essay. I think it goes places that you don't think it's going to go. I remember when I first read it, I kind of rolled my eyes and thought, oh no, not another one of these. And I had my doubts, but I shouldn't have doubted, because by the end of it, I was just floored. This is one of my favorite pieces we've ever published, because I think he's unafraid to really go there and really say provocative things like, the American public cares more about dogs than it does about dead Iraqis in this war. And does it in a way that I don't think alienates the reader, you know, is set up to not avoid that.
I thought it was an excellent piece, because I read quite a few accounts of the Iraq War. I've talked to veterans of the conflict. I have not read a better piece than this one, in terms of just the quality of the writing, the insights, the bravery, essentially, in unmasking himself. I mean, because Orwell's talking about, he doesn't want to be seen as a fool. And Orwell is so good at self-effacing honesty. And that's what's happening here. And it's a remarkable piece. Really is. It's the snickering Iraqis that almost goads him into shooting, because he wants to think that he's superior, but then maybe he's not. Can't you even shoot this dog that's already, you know, suffering and in the compound? And what kind of marksmanship and what kind of war machinery do you really run here that you're not up to this task? Yeah, great stuff.
Right. And he's not even the one pulling the trigger, right? It's someone in the platoon, but because of this collective identity, he kind of takes it on. Yeah. And the last line of the essay is just a kicker, so I won't ruin it for listeners.
But it is really well written. At one point, he's talking about the dog's whine rose and fell like a police siren. And thinking of when I'm in London anytime, that strange whirling sound of the British police sirens, that really came home for me. Let's move to another piece, The Lives of Brian. This is by Jennifer Sonor. It's from the summer 2023 issue. Her brother goes through a series of near deaths before a final death. Maybe want to lay the background for this one and what struck you?
I love this piece by Jennifer Sonor. It is an essay about the death of her brother. The essay starts with her and her family in the airport, and she gets a call that her brother, Brian, has died. Specifically, she hears the words, "We lost Brian." And so the essay unfolds over the various times in which they've lost Brian before, and what loss means in all of its permutations. And, you know, what I really love about this essay so much is that she not only goes through all of the permutations of what losing someone is like, or what loss can mean, whether it's loss of control, whether it's loss of, a person, as in, like, we don't know where they are, or whether it's losses in the final loss of death, or any number of other definitions, but does it in a way that somehow manages to encapsulate, you know, throughout this very controlled kind of narrative where we have these various moments where this is the second time we lost Brian, this was the first time we lost Brian, et cetera. Somehow the current moment of grief always punctures through. And so it feels just really raw and visceral and kind of uncontrollable and is doing that fine dance throughout.
Well, I love that you brought up all the ways in which we can have loss, because there's a contravening element, which is the guy's a hoarder. So he's got a mobile home. And by definition, a mobile home should suggest that you are fleet of foot and can move around. Of course, many mobile homes do not do that. They're stationary. But this is a person who is hoarding. And the hoarding, as brought up by the father, really packs a punch. I don't want to step on your toes, so maybe you want to explicate that, and then I maybe have an extra observation.
Yeah, I mean, essentially after that phone call, Jennifer and her family cancel the vacation, and then she and her family convene at that mobile home and have to deal with all the stuff that Brian has left. And the way she categorizes it is, you know, they're going through it. They're tossing stuff into a dumpster. And then her father, something clicks, because her father suffers from the same illness that Brian did, which Jennifer calls a fear of losing, a fear that this AutoZone receipt from 2005 must be saved because bad things will happen if it is lost, you know? And it just, it seems the way she introduces that, it just makes sense, right? Like the understand, oh yes, this is what hoarding is about. It can be about a fear of losing. And so even in this immensely crowded mobile home, somehow the fear of loss is still permeating as they're all reckoning with the actual loss of Brian.
And for me as a reader, I'm prepared for that, because we've had all these instances where we have indeed almost lost Brian. And the idea that the world has its vagaries and that life is untrustworthy, and the only thing you can count on is to amass this ridiculous amount of stuff and embed it in your life, is somehow some bulwark against the fates. And of course, they're not. Yeah, it's a great piece. And it really, it just is like almost like cannon shot right from the beginning, because we lost Brian, and the next words are the cavernous space between each word as she hears that announcement. So, I mean, I was 10 words into this essay and I was hooked. And that's part of the power of the writing.
I think it's really hard to do that with essays about loss or grief, because there are so many innumerable essays about that. I mean, the human compulsion to write is about, you know, for a lot of people, I think for a lot of us, even if you're not a professional writer, is about wrestling with those personal emotions. But to make it feel so raw and so fresh and so compelling, for people outside.
Raw yet controlled, as you said. It doesn't wallow in self-pity. No. It doesn't wander off the map in any number of ways that could have been interest to the essay. It's a really well done piece. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like a tightrope walk of grief almost.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Moving to Winter 2024, An Outrage Sacred to the Gods. This is by Greg Afinagup. He's Russian by ancestry. His father still there until he passes away. It brings in Sophocles and Antigone. That's a connection. That's not my forte, the Greek classics. Can you maybe set up how that is integral to the piece?
Yeah. So Greg Afinaginov is a friend of mine, and we had been talking about his father's death, and he had been connecting it to Antigone in some way, specifically because his father died shortly before the war in Ukraine broke out, and the funeral preparations or the anniversary of the his death was exceedingly difficult for Greg to celebrate to address because of the war, right? And so suddenly Russia is closed off, and he has to deal with sort of the guilt he felt, I think, about returning and trying to do honor to a family member with whom he has this complicated relationship. And the connection he drew was to Antigone, who similarly tries to bury her fallen brother, in contrast to what Creon has set out as the given law. And, you know, what I love about this is it goes through the traditional reading of Antigone, you know, and that, you know, we're supposed to know what each of these figures is standing for. But, you know, the connection to the war, the contemporary war, and the, you know, the line that it's hardly the moment to consider a man who died before the invasion, whose death can't be attributed to the malice of a despot. So how could Greg, you know, try to go back and try to do, you know, focus on this really small tragedy in the midst of this really grand one unspooling in which thousands of people are affected? But in the end, you know, comes around to like, well, private ritual actually makes loss and mourning meaningful. And maybe that's the reading of Antigone. But he doesn't stop there. It's not just this connection to Antigone. The essay then starts to unspool over Russia along the river Vos and into all kinds of areas of personal history, of Russian history, of family history, some of which is still buried. So yeah, there's all the essay is working on a lot of different levels here and a lot of different references, but never feels cluttered. You know, it all comes together and it all kind of makes sense. And there's a twist too.
Sure. So I've always had a tremendous interest in Russian history and literature, maybe because I'm from the Great Plains. And so we have our own version of the tundra in places like Minnesota, North Dakota. So I there was an angle to the Russian psyche that I was interested in. He admits that his father was an alcoholic. He struggled with it himself. I guess we have the advantage here since you know Greg. Have you had a discussion about the role of, I guess I almost had to call it dysfunctionality, ennui, despair in the Russian psyche and where that comes from? Because he admits that, you know, hard drinking is a national ritual. And okay. I've had occasion to be to Russia. I would say that's true. Lots of other testaments to that. Why is that the case? Has he, I mean, it comes up a bit in the essay, but if we can even go beyond the confines of the essay to any conversation you might have had, I'm just curious about the role of those emotions and of alcohol in the, I guess I'll call it the Russian psyche.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the essay kind of wrestles with that. And like, can you really just pin it on tradition or is that a really convenient excuse? You know, sure. The Russian people are not the only ones who have a hard drinking culture. I come from Austria on my mom's side and similar issues abound. I think for me...
Greenland, which has a like,
exactly.
Alcohol, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think part of it is just the isolation, but isolation isn't just geographic, right? It can be personal. And isolation from other family members, Greg's grandmother, for instance, coming up and dealing with her own kind of addictions, born perhaps out of that kind of isolation from family members, physically, also isolation from Moscow. For me, the essay, you know, in its original form, there was still this exploration of sort of what drinking means for both his family and also for the Russian people. But what was missing was his own relationship with alcohol. And so that's, I think, one of the ways in which it can really help to have, and this isn't true all the time, but if you have like an existing relationship with the writers you're working with, as an editor, you can ask hard questions that maybe would leave others that you don't have that relationship with kind of aghast, like, how dare you? But I was like, you know, why don't we talk about your own relationship here? And it just like that made the piece. I remember when I sent that to Sudip, our editor, he was like, I gasped.
I thought the piece took another step, valuable step, when it tackled that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So before we run out, I wanted to get to one more. This is from Patricia Hample, actually from my home state of Minnesota. It's called I'll Be Seeing You. It's from the spring 2023 issue. She's making a pilgrimage to England. It's actually her first trip abroad ever, I believe, to see someone who was on intimate, close terms with Catherine Mansfield, the New Zealand writer. A little bit of background you want to give on this piece?
Yeah, so this is one of several pieces, the latest of the essays that Patricia Hample has written for us. And I think it's my favorite. What I love about it so much is that she's writing from a greater distance, right? She is an older woman now, writing about a time when she was quite young and naive and was given this mission. And maybe it was from Miss Magazine. Was it a commission? Did I have a commission? I'm not quite sure. But it doesn't really matter. You know, it's just a fabulous exploration of like of memory and the vagaries of memory, but how important they can be to your development as a person. The essay sort of shifts over time too. Originally, you think it's about Hample's obsession with Catherine Mansfield and trying to get to the woman who was closest to her. But then really, it turns out it's actually about the British man who connected her to that person, Peter, and becomes about their friendship too. So I just love this essay because it embodies to me just like the shifting nature of memory and how it intersects with fiction writing even. You know, she refers to the fiction writing of memory at one point, and how in hindsight we're always rewriting or amplifying certain things, but then when you look back, things change again, and we're always reassessing. So I love this piece. I think the tone is really, really fun. It feels light, but also it's really, you know, it's not afraid to go to heavy places either.
Yeah, to me, it speaks to the whole nature of what the essay means, the term literally to take a walk, to make a try, an attempt. So she goes one place, she makes an attempt. Leslie Moore, the companion of Catherine Mansfield, basically shuts her out, but Peter does not. And so that's really where the fruits of the effort to get abroad, you know, bear the most. And I thought really an interesting moment was when Peter said, well, you know, I'm pure homosexual. I guess someone else makes that comment. And it means he's outside the class system, because having studied at Oxford, I can tell you the class is certainly well alive in England. It's amazing. And she notes it in the essay that people can detect where you're from and your social class by your accent. They can do so very adroitly and very quickly. And everyone gets pegged. And it's really hard. But there she was as the Midwestern American, as much of an outsider as Peter, thanks to his homosexuality, as much as Catherine Mansfield, thanks to being from New Zealand. And I thought that was really an interesting step as the essay, as you said, shifts.
And what I love about that moment, too, is you can see her evolving, right? She's trying to play, and she's like, well, I don't know where I fit in class-wise. I'm Midwestern. Well, no, I'm not Midwest. I'm just American. And you can see her sort of start to define herself. And then the way that Peter sort of brings her in and says like, oh, you and me were both outside.
Yeah.
And just that building up their relationship and characterization is just so lovely.
And they have an alliance in a way, because she admits, which I think takes some courage, given her status, that she takes on Virginia Woolf a bit and admits that she has some discomfort. And Peter says, well, my compatriot in Penn was Susan Sontag, and she was a terrible person and a fake. So they're both taking on a literary lion in a way, even though they would have, you know, seemingly less status, especially as outsiders, no less. That's one of many ways in which they kind of form a bond. And I thought it was very charming. And it did go places I didn't expect. I really thought she was going to get a in-depth interview, and we were going to hear about Catherine Mansfield, and that's not particularly what happened. It does have, by the way, I must say in closing, one of the most lovely descriptions of English cooking, which is often atrocious. She writes, two eggs, the whites cruelly fried as if electrocuted, potatoes gluey in some kind of motor oil. Having puzzled over English cuisine many a time, that was just great stuff. So that's really nice writing, very evocative.
And it speaks to how much food sticks in our memory for ill or for better.
Yes, yeah. She has a much clearer impression of that than some other things, some of the details. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being my guest and for your wonderful insights and all that. So this has been Stephanie Bastick. She is the senior editor for The American Scholar. This is my latest essay episode of Great New American Essays. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Dan, for having me.